Welcome to another edition of A Better You with Coach Caroline. I am your host, Coach Caroline Miller. Today I'm so excited that we are speaking with Barry Schwartz, who I was fortunate enough to meet as a student at the MAP program at the University of Pennsylvania last year. And Barry came to teach from Swarthmore College, where he has taught since receiving his PhD in 1971. And he is the author, most recently, of a really, really terrific book called The Paradox of Choice, Why Less is More. And in this book, he discusses why more choice can lead to paralysis in decision-making and even lower well-being. So Barry's also published hundreds of articles. I think I read in your biography, there's so much, you know, that you've done. But I'd love to focus on this, Barry. So welcome, and here we go. You there?
Hi Caroline. Thanks for having
Barry.
Me.
All right, well, I'm going to throw you an easy one just to start with, because I'm starting with this with a lot of people. I'm getting very interesting answers. How would you define positive psychology?
I think positive psychology is the organized effort to first identify the strengths that enable people to live satisfying, meaningful lives, and then identify techniques to encourage people to cultivate those strengths.
Okay. And do you think it has staying power as it's defined right now?
I have some quarrels with its definition and the course it's actually currently on, but I absolutely think it has staying power.
Okay. And have you seen changes in your own life as a result of being part of this movement to bring it more to the mainstream?
Well, I would say the answer to that is yes. I'm lucky, since many of the sort of pieces of advice that I find most resonant are things that I had already kind of done in a less self-conscious way. So I've just become much more self-conscious about operating in the world in a way that sort of promotes my well-being and other people's.
Yeah, you and me both. A master's degree has made me very thoughtful about what I'm doing. Okay, so let's go right into your terrific book and kind of the meat of it. Why is too much choice so paralyzing and even depressing?
So here's the problem. We have been led to believe by our political leaders, our philosophical leaders, and our psychological leaders that choice is a really important thing for well-being. People should be autonomous. They should be in control of their own lives. It's what the Declaration of Independence is all about: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Seligman's older work on learned helplessness told us about how important choice and control is for well-being. So we believe that choice is essential. And what we have assumed, without evidence, is that if some choice is good, then more choice is better.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, based only on research that's been done in the last half dozen years or so, that that perfectly plausible assumption, if some is good, more is better, that perfectly plausible assumption is false. You can give people so many options that it can have three really, really unfortunate negative effects. First, it can paralyze people so that even though they are faced with this incredibly liberating array of possibilities, they choose none of the above. And this is true of trivial things like buying cereal and not so trivial things like deciding what to do with their lives when they finish college.
Hmm.
So paralysis, because it's hard to know how to choose from such a large and attractive set.
Mm-hmm.
If you overcome paralysis and choose, there's good reason to worry that people will choose less wisely, because it's just too hard to do all the information gathering and evaluation when the option set is very, very big.
Mm-hmm.
You adopt simplifying strategies to actually enable you to make a decision, and the simple decision is not necessarily the best decision. But that's what we're sort of driven to in self-defense when we're faced with 100 or 1,000 possibilities.
Okay, so that...
Oh,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the final thing, which is what I focus most of my attention on, is if you overcome paralysis and choose well, you will likely be less satisfied with your decision than you would have been if you had chosen from a smaller set of options.
Hmm.
And that's the one that's, I think, most surprising to people. And the reason is that if you consider a lot of options, chances are many of them will be attractive in one way or another. There won't be one option that is simply the best in every respect. No job is the perfect job. No spouse is the perfect spouse, and so on. And so as you contemplate all these options, you are saying no to one attractive thing after another. And when you finally say yes to something, what you spend your time thinking about is all those attractive things you passed up.
Isn't that, that is so true. Ever since you taught us that about opportunity costs.
Opportunity costs, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you can easily see it. You know, you try to decide where to go on vacation. You pick some spot, but then you're thinking about the great restaurants in this place and the great culture in that place and the mountains you could climb in that place. And if you spend your time on the beach thinking about the culture, restaurants, and mountains, you're not going to have much fun at the beach.
Right. And, you know, the other thing I found that's so, I think, tied in with that is all of these great websites that allow you to look at fares, great deals on airfare. I end up getting paralyzed because there's so many great deals, and I'm giving up, or I'm doing what you talked about. There's opportunity cost to everything I decide not to pursue.
Yep.
So I end up clicking off these wonderful websites without making a decision.
Oh, I think it's true at every level. You walk into a great store that's got native arts and crafts, and there are so many wonderful things you don't know how to choose, so you end up walking out with nothing.
Well, that's a perfect segue into a question I'm sure you're expecting and you're used to answering, which is, what is a maximizer and what is a satisficer, and how can we become one of them in our lives to make us
so happy? My book makes a big deal of this distinction. My colleagues and I studied it based on an idea that a very distinguished psychologist named Herb Simon articulated half a century ago. And the rough idea is this: if you are out to get the best, vacation, job, cereal, whatever, we call it that. That's, we define that as a maximizer. You want the best. Now, you know, the only way to know you've got the best is by examining all the possibilities. And in the world we live in, that's impossible. There are just too many.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that either you won't be able to decide at all, or you'll decide with lots of possibilities unexamined and end up convinced that if you'd looked a little more or a little harder, you'd have found something better.
Right. And
so
being
a maximizer is not necessarily a problem in a world with limited options. But in the world we live in, it's a major problem. The alternative, which we call satisficing, is simply looking for a good enough job, vacation, CD player, or spouse. Good enough can be very good. You can have very high standards. You can have not so high standards. But the point is, you know what your standards are, and as soon as you find something that meets them, you pick it. And there's much less reason for you to worry that if you'd looked a little longer, you'd have found something better. So the argument that I make in the book is that being a maximizer in the modern world is a real recipe for misery. You'll do better with a lot of your decisions, but you'll feel worse about virtually all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And
go ahead.
Well, the second question you asked is how do you become a satisficer? And I don't know the answer to that except to say nobody is a maximizer about everything, which means that everybody knows how to settle for good enough.
That's such a good point.
Yeah, I think it is. And the trick is simply to take strategies you already use and apply them in areas where you currently don't apply them. You know, if you're willing to eat a good enough cereal or choose or go to a good enough restaurant, maybe you should also be willing to take a good enough job, that
okay.
kind of thing. You know how to do it. You just have to generalize it to new areas of life, which is easier than learning a whole new set of skills. And I don't think anybody is a maximizer across the board.
Well, that leads me to a question which came up privately among a bunch of my classmates after you taught us. What are some of the clever ways? Because some of my classmates have come up with very clever ways to become satisficers after you taught us, and I wanted to share them with you after I hear some ideas from you about some really clever, life-changing ways you've heard people become satisficers in different areas of their lives, if you know of any kind of case histories like that.
I actually don't. I'm eager to hear what you have to say. I mean, I have heard of clever ways to manage the choice problem. And I'll mention just two of them. One is simply to establish a rule that limits the amount of searching you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may be 200 websites where you can buy a toaster, but you're only going to look at two.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to choose. And at first it's probably going to make you squirm a little bit because surely there's a better toaster out there somewhere. But you, after you get used to it and you discover that there's these 2 hours that you didn't spend looking for a goddamn $20 toaster, that instead you spent being a good spouse or a good parent or a good friend, I think you start to reap the benefits and the squirming diminishes. That's one strategy. And another one is what I call choosing when to choose. And what I mean there is delegate decisions to other people. Ask a friend what digital camera to buy. Ask another friend where to go on vacation. Trust your friends. They don't need to know any more about this than you do. They just need to not know less than you do and not be out to sort of purposely steer you in the wrong direction. And you will pay none of the price of doing this agonized searching because someone else has done it, and you derive the benefit. You go to a good place, and you don't have these opportunity costs because you haven't even done the comparisons.
Right. And so is there a downside to being a satisficer, any downside at all?
Well, I suppose the downside is that you end up doing less well objectively than you would if you were out to get the best. So then now the question we have to ask ourselves is what's more important in decisions, how good they are objectively or how good the people who make them think they are?
Oh.
And I think it is surprisingly rare that the objective quality of the decision is more important than the subjective quality.
Oh, that's
even
interesting.
This is another very unintuitive thing, and it's worth unpacking just a little. Take something like choosing a doctor. Suppose you have a serious illness. Almost everyone would agree that this is about as important a decision as there is. And it seems like here's the case where you want the best doctor, period. But here's my thinking. You're living in a place like, I don't know, New York or L.A. or even in Philadelphia. There are trillions of doctors to choose from. You search and search and search and search, and you realize that by the time you finish searching, you'd be dead. Mm-hmm. So you finally pick one. And, you know, it's a great doctor. Is it the best doctor? You don't know if it's the best doctor. And the doctor tells you a whole bunch of stuff that you need to do in order to get yourself healthy, that it will make demands on you. Exercise. Change your diet. Do this. Take your meds. And how likely are you to comply with what is, after all, a fairly taxing, unpleasant regimen of treatment? Well, it seems to me that if you leave this doctor wondering whether this was actually the best doctor, you're going to be much less inclined to follow the doctor's advice than if you see a doctor and are confident that you should follow the doctor's recommendations.
Right.
So even though you got a better doctor, there's still going to be this nagging doubt about whether you got the best doctor, and that may result in your being sort of less motivated to do the things the doctor tells you to do in order to get healthy. So I think most of the time there's no price in settling for good enough.
Okay, and I would agree with that after having really thought this through in the last year. One of my classmates instituted a rule as a result of your work, which is no more than 2 minutes answering an email. And he was talking to me about it one day, and I decided to try it too. And I have to tell you, I've become a satisficer in answering emails, and it's really cut a lot of worry.
Meaning
off.
That you don't revise and edit and make sure you've said it in exactly the right way?
Right, or if I see someone's name highlighted and I know it's someone I really want to spend a lot of time thinking about my response and making sure I include all the details of what it is I know they're going to want to learn about, I end up, you know, procrastinating, which is an emotional hangover that's not worth having.
Yep.
And so this 2 minutes per email rule has really transformed my workday in ways I really didn't expect. But
that is a great idea.
Yeah, and so I found that I've been able to transfer this 2 minutes to other kinds of things in my life, like 2 minutes working on a scrapbook page, no more than three. And I'm finding I'm becoming a satisficer in places I didn't know I could do it simply by adhering to a time limit. So.
And you're finding that you don't feel like you're giving much up?
I just feel better because things are getting done.
Uh-huh. And they're getting done to well enough to meet your standards.
Well, no one's complaining. That's the interesting thing. So the critical reviews haven't rolled in, and that gives me this further empowerment to do the two-minute rule everywhere else in life. So
I got to say, I think that it's rare that people are going to notice that you're, as it were, settling for mediocrity, because you're not settling for mediocrity. I analogize this to the problem that places like Swarthmore face when it comes to admitting a class of students. you know, we get 5 to 8 times more applicants than we have spaces for, and because we have this reputation for being a great school, most of the applicants are very good. Mm-hmm. So we could almost pick names at random and have a fine entering class. But, of course, you're not allowed to do that. It's unseemly to admit students at random. So we agonize to choose the very best from this set of wonderful students, and I think this is worse than pointless. I don't think we get in any better class than we would if we used a good enough criterion.
Mm-hmm.
And B, we put this unbelievable pressure on high school kids to look better than their classmates.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we simply adopted a good enough criterion, which in the case of Swarthmore would be very good, it's a very selective place,
mm-hmm.
and then from that set picked at random, nobody would know.
You know, and I was reading a front-page article in the New York Times. It was on Sunday, 2 Sundays ago, about the incredible hell a lot of very elite high school students in Newton, Massachusetts.
Yep, yeah, I read the article, too. It breaks your heart.
It does, and I was thinking about you as I read it, because I thought, what if all of those schools those kids applied to, and they were all deserving students, and there was one in particular who got rejected, all kinds of places who would have been an asset to anybody's community. What if all those schools adopted a good enough policy like you had suggested? I think the quality of people's lives all over the country would be radically transformed. So maybe that's really your next book.
Well, look, I've been saying this and writing this at every chance I get, because I really think that colleges like mine and the Ivy League are just killing kids, and there's no reason to do things this way, but nobody takes it seriously. Nobody is willing even to do the experiment of adopting a good enough criterion and then choosing at random among the students who meet that criterion. And I think I think that will transform the admissions process, and the result will be that high school becomes less of a pressure cooker. And
right.
By the way, there's a very good clinical psychologist at Columbia named Sunya Luthar, who has found that the incidence of psychopathology and drug abuse in adolescents in upper middle class suburbs is exactly as high as the frequency of psychopathology and substance abuse in the inner city.
Oh.
Slightly different pathology and slightly different drugs of choice, but the incidence is the same. And her account of why it's happening in upper middle class suburbs is principally because of pressure to achieve.
Interesting.
And why is there this pressure to achieve? Because everybody wants to get into Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, and Swarthmore, and in order to do that, they need to be a little tiny bit better than the people to their left and the people to their right.
Mm.
So I think we're really destroying a generation.
Oh, I think you're right. In a book called The Overachievers came out last year that dealt with the lives of about 5 to 10 students in a high school that's 5 minutes from my house, Walt Whitman in Bethesda, Maryland. And you can't not read that and not think about, you know, something has to change because...
Yep.
Anyway, well, my last question, and there's so many I could ask, but is about comparisons. You talk about upward and downward comparisons and how they can make you feel. Can you just explain a little bit about how that can either work to or against your advantage? Or?
Well, sure. So, you know, you're trying to decide whether how good a student you are or how good a job you've got or how good looking you are. So how do you answer questions like this? You answer them by looking around at other people and comparing yourself to other people. And as near as I can tell, this is simply what we do. Now, you can look at other people who are worse than you. This is the so-called downward comparison, and you'll feel better. You know, my job's okay, but her job's worse.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky me. You can compare yourself to people who are doing better than you and feel worse, so-called upward comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, these two kinds of comparisons should sort of cancel out. You get a boost from downward comparisons. You get a kick in the behind from upward comparisons. And so you end up basically in the same place on average. But for reasons that I don't understand, it looks like a lot of people don't get a boost from downward comparisons. That is, they don't feel better when they're comparing themselves to people who are in worse shape than they are. And they do feel worse when they're comparing themselves to people who are in better shape than
right.
they are. And so the result is that it looks like, in general, social comparison is a recipe for misery because you're going to suffer from the negative comparisons but not benefit from the positive ones. Is this fixable? I think it probably is. And one thing that's certainly a core piece of positive psychology that helps is going through these gratitude exercises mm-hmm. that get you to focus on what's good about this, that, and the other thing, trivial or important, rather than on what's bad or disappointing. And it's conceivable, though I don't know that anyone has studied this, that if you develop the habit of gratitude, of appreciation of what's good in your life, you will suffer less from downward social comparison and benefit more from upward social comparison. But I don't know that anyone has studied it.
Oh, there's a great capstone project right there for someone at Penn.
You think?
I think so, because I'm carrying around a little book with a smiley face on it that I bought at a store called The Papery, and I write all my blessings down all day as they occur. And it is such a noticeable difference in my life that I think you're right. I think the comparisons would kind of, the sting would be eased if people were more conscious of what it was.
One of the things, just I know this has to end, but one of the things we find in our research is that maximizers seem especially attuned to these upward social comparisons. It bothers them worse than it bothers satisficers when they encounter someone who is doing better than they are. So that's another reason why being a maximizer is a recipe for unhappiness.
Well, it's a great book, Barry, and
I really recommend
it to everybody, and I'll be teaching students this year, and everyone's going to read it. But I appreciate the time and the persistence and the grit in getting this call done. And I just want to close with, this does conclude today's podcast with Barry Schwartz, a professor at Swarthmore, and who's written a great book, which has really gotten a nice plug here because I think it's a book everybody should read and have and refer to often. So please visit my website, www.carolinemiller.com. Click on the Blinking Podcast link to learn more about today's link, including a link to his book and websites that he would like us to visit. So until next time, this is Coach Caroline wishing you a happy, proactive, and very successful day.